So this is actually week 7 and third week of this particular series to be taking things from the festivals. Just a reminder that this is the last shiur before Rosh Hashanah. So it's the last shiur of this Jewish year. We are going to just watch all the notifications. We're obviously going to resume in the next term after Sukkot and so on. However, I just want to mention, I don't know the date exactly and the time, but I will spread it around, but just to make a mental note that this year I'm very excited. We're going to go back to our yearly Sukkot gathering in my sukkah at home. Probably the Thursday morning of Sukkot, but I'll put that all out there as soon as we can. So just a bit of review. Last week we looked at the shofar. We looked at the concept, the story of life, how everyone has a purity, an essential purity, but then we've got to put it into practice in the world of challenge, which then emerges into a renewed purity, much, much stronger, which we said was also the story of the tkiyah, the tru'ah, and the tkiyah. That's how the shofar works, the smooth, long sound, which is the first purity, the essential purity, the shvarim tkiyah, which are the broken sounds, the space of challenge, and then the final tkiyah, which is the stronger purity, which emerges having been tested in the world of challenge, in the world of complexity, and coming out so much stronger. Okay. So before we go to today's topic, I just want to make two announcements, and that is, this coming Monday night, we're going to do a Zoom session. You'll remember last year we did a large Zoom session to help everyone pray at home. So this time we're going to do a Zoom session to help everyone pray in shul. The service in Rosh Hashanah often is complicated. Everyone looks around. Everyone sits there thinking they're the only one who doesn't know what's going on. And the truth is that most people don't know what's going on. So that's fine. So I want to just do a Zoom on the machzor, some insights, and also some things of what happens in shul, why it happens, the understanding of it. That's this Monday night at 8:00. If you've got an art scroll machzor that you can bring with you to your computer, that's great, because we'll be using some of the pages there. Join us. That's this coming Monday night. And just remind everyone again that we do have the second day of Rosh Hashanah, a very spiritual, meaningful service in Vaucluse. It's at the home, the Spiridis home. If you know one that's interested, who I'm not in the business of taking people away from other shuls, but if people don't have a shul or that not we weren't planning to go to shul, this could be a really, really good option and a very meaningful experience. So spread the word. Okay. So today's topic is Kol Nidre. Everyone knows Kol Nidre, right? Probably, I would say, I don't know if I'm accurate, but probably, it's probably the fullest time in shuls world over, right? I think?
Yeah. Accurate,
okay. Everyone knows, you've got to go to shul. You know, I once tried to talk someone to come here for shofar, whatever. Nah, he goes Kol Nidre. Okay. That's something. And everyone knows Kol Nidre. People are familiar with the tunes of Kol Nidre a bit. It sort of arouses like a stir. Probably the most serious time of Yom Kippur, maybe the beginning. And then at the end, maybe La'ilah. But the real question is, what is Kol Nidre? What is this prayer? What is this prayer called Kol Nidre? And why do we say it? Why is it so important? Anyone know what Kol Nidre is?
Vows.
So that's nice.
So can you explain?
Yeah, so thank you. That's exactly right. Because if anyone looks in the English, it maybe isn't such a good idea. Kol Nidre is actually not a very inspiring prayer. In fact, Kol Nidre is not a prayer altogether. It's a legal declaration. That's all it is. If you look in the English, it says that any vow, any promise that I take on. Now, in Jewish, it's true that in Jewish thinking, vows are big problems. No. You shouldn't make a promise. To break a promise is a bad thing, and so on. So we start Yom Kippur, we say, Kol Nidre, anyone that's going to make all my promises, all my oaths, all my vows, all my this, all my that, from this Yom Kippur, next Yom Kippur, they should be null and void, yeah. Right? It's a purely legal declaration, because there is a mechanism in the Torah to annul vows. If you make a vow, it's very serious if you don't keep it. There's a mechanism to annul vows. Yom Kippur night, we take out the Torahs. They stand next to the chazan. Halachically, legally, that kind of creates a little bit of a based-in, so to speak, concept. It's like a court, and therefore, in front of everyone, we make a declaration annulling the vows that we might make, and so on. What do? We make this legal declaration. If you ask a lawyer about this, they think it's crazy. And we put it to a very stirring tune, right? Which the tune, seemingly on the surface, the words do not match the tune at all, right? My vows are no vows. I mean, like, what is that supposed to mean, right? And yet, it seems to be, everyone knows Kol Nidre, and it seems to be the foundational prayer of Yom Kippur. It's the way we start Yom Kippur. It somehow, for some reason, sets the tone for Yom Kippur. Okay. So, just to go through a couple of things first before we go into a very beautiful and deep idea, an important lesson actually. There's some people that claim that solemnness, its seriousness, dates back to the days of the Spanish Inquisition, right? Because what happened in the Spanish Inquisition, you know, there were those people that were called the conversos. They converted outwardly to Christianity, but nevertheless, inwardly, they kept their Jewishness. They had a very derogatory name that was given to them by the Spanish at the time, called the Muranos. Muranos actually means a pig. And because they sensed that their conversion was not real, and it actually wasn't real, they used to try and hunt them down. They used to try and discover the hidden shuls, the hidden cellars that they would do the prayers in, and so on and so forth. But outwardly, these people who were unwilling or unable to leave Spain at the time, they kept their Jewishness inside, but outwardly they were committed to the church, right? And the story goes that on Yom Kippur night, they would find this hidden shul and gather together very, 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 very sort of quietly in a deep cellar somewhere to have a minyan. But they would start begging Hashem for forgiveness. And what they would do is they would start with Kol Nidre. They would say all the promises, all the commitments, all the things that I've made to the church are null and void. I don't mean them. My faith is with you, God, and we're going to now, on that note, we're going to start the prayers of Yom Kippur, which gives it some context, at least, to the seriousness of why it's so far. But the problem with that reason is it's historically incorrect, because Kol Nidre dates back about 500 years before the Spanish Inquisition. So it's a little bit later. It could be it was given much more weight then, and it's also possible, I have heard this theory, that the tune comes from there. In other words, what they did was, the actual Kol Nidre was there before, but they're the ones who put it to a tune. Right? They're the ones putting it to a tune, and that tune is very solemn, and in the context of what they were going through, and they were experiencing, the tune makes a lot of sense, and that's what gives it. But the truth is, that's very nice, that's a very historic reason. What's going to do with us? I mean, it's a nice thing, but how does it set the tone for Yom Kippur for us, and why is it so important, and why are people drawn to Kol Nidre? Just one other short insight, which isn't the main insight I want to share, but I'll just share with you anyways. We've often talked about the concept of the power of speech, right? Koach HaDibur. Now, we know that the human being has this amazing tool, the tool of communication, the tool of speech. Speech has an amazing power. The essence of the human being is all about words and speech and so on and so forth. So, yeah. That all makes sense. But on Yom Kippur, on Yom Kippur, we particularly use speech in a very real way to reconnect with God. You will know that, first of all, prayer, of course, in Jewish context, prayer is not meditative. I mean, we meditate, but prayer is not meditative. Prayer is verbal, right? We're supposed to say the words. Particularly on Yom Kippur, we have a mitzvah, part of the tshuva process, part of the asking God for forgiveness, to actually verbalize and enunciate things we might have done wrong. That's why we have the al-chait, the vidui, the confessions that we say throughout Yom Kippur, right? And we use the mechanisms of speech to give it extra power and extra energy, and that's part of the process of Yom Kippur, the purity of speech. But we want, as we go into Yom Kippur, we want our speech to be pure. We want the tool that we're going to use. Like Rosh Hashanah is a bit different. Rosh Hashanah, we blow the shofar, we eat apple and honey. There's different things that we do. Yom Kippur is all about speech, all about words. And therefore, going into Yom Kippur, we want our words to be pure, and therefore we say Kol Nidre first, in case, yeah.
Sorry, Rabbi, that previous slide, I don't know if you explained the significance of it.
No, I just took a picture of the computer. I don't know. I think it's an ancient cover of a machzor or something. I don't know what it is.
Oh, okay.
I was just looking for an image in your Uncle Nidre, and I saw that. It looked good.
No.
I'm not sure what it is.
It looks like a wine label.
No. I hope it's not a wine label, because drinking wine on Yom Kippur is a slight problem. But anyway. Right? So going into Yom Kippur, we reflect and we think to ourselves, look, maybe throughout the year we've defiled our speech in some level. Maybe we made a vow and we didn't keep to it, which is a blemish on our speech, right? So we try and fix that as Yom Kippur goes on, so that our speech should be pure, and we go into the Yom Kippur service. Okay, so that's just an insight that I saw that I wanted to share with you. But we still need to understand, why is it the prayer? Why is it Kol Nidre, right? So I'm going to share with you an amazing insight, which I think has an incredibly important lesson. Going into, it's a lesson not just Yom Kippur, it's a lesson going into Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, this whole period that we're going into general, which is the period of change, period of improvement, and so on. And I hope you'll enjoy it as I did. But I want to just preface it by the following. The way we actually do Kol Nidre, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, when we open up the Machzor, the main part of that prayer is actually Kol Nidre, the annulment of vows, but actually there's also two other components in the Kol Nidre service. What I mean by the Kol Nidre service is, when you go to Shul and Yom Kippur night, there's two parts of the service. There's Kol Nidre, and then some sort of a sermon, and then they have the evening prayers. I'm talking about just the Kol Nidre, right, the beginning. So what happens is, actually three parts. There's a very interesting declaration that the Chazan makes before they start Kol Nidre. As the Yom Kippur prayers begin, the Chazan says, with the agreement, and this goes back from the Talmud about how we pray on fast days and so on, The Chazan says, with the agreement and the knowledge of the earthly court, together with the knowledge of the heavenly court, Anu Matirin, we permit and we include everyone in the prayers, and we permit even the great sinners to be involved and be included in the prayers of Yom Kippur. We include everyone, that everyone is supposed to be there, everyone is meant to be there. No one is excluded, even if it might be someone that is a very bad transgressor. They're all included in the prayers of Yom Kippur, and it's considered an important thing. After that, we go to Kol Nidre. And the third thing we do after Kol Nidre is we make the blessing of Shehechiyanu. Now, a simple reason for that is because when else should we make it? Normally on a Chag, on a festival, when a new festival comes, we make the blessing of Shehechiyanu, and that's done by Kiddush. We make a home, and we have Kiddush over wine. We include in the Kiddush the blessing of Shehechiyanu. Of course, Yom Kippur, you can't do that. So it's made in Shul after Kol Nidre, at the beginning of Kol Nidre. But it's interesting that it becomes part of the service of Kol Nidre. And I wanted to mention that, because at the very end I'm going to come back to that and show you the connection of all these three things. Right? Of why this concept of permitting the sinners to be included in the prayer is connected to Kol Nidre, which then follows on to Shehechiyanu. Okay. So, let me take you on a bit of a journey. I'm going to go to something that we talk about during Yom Kippur day in the prayers. And that is the service of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, that took place in the temple. In temple times, just to give you a bit of context, in temple times, Yom Kippur looked very, very different. Jews would make their way to the temple. The prayers would be much shorter than it is today. The main focus of Yom Kippur would actually be the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, who would be in charge, and he would do most of the rituals that day, and they would observe, and he would lead the people. He would ask God for forgiveness on behalf of the people. He would bring various different sacrifices and so and do various different things, and he would be the person. He was a holy person, generally speaking. He was handpicked. There was a certain level of eligibility that you had to have to become a high priest, and he would be the one representing the Jewish nation on the day of Yom Kippur. One of the things that the Kohen Gadol, I think we've mentioned this before, but one of the things that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, would do on Yom Kippur and Yom Kippur only, he would go into, you see the picture, we go into the Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Holy of Holies. Now the temple had different spots of different levels of holiness. The whole thing was very holy, but it had different areas of different holiness. the high priest, no one was ever allowed to go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, was the room that housed the Ark, in which was the tablets, the Ten Commandments, and a Torah scroll, and so on. That was the holiest spot. No one was ever allowed to go there. It was considered dangerous to go there if you weren't eligible to go there. And only once a year, the great Kohen Gadol, representing the Jewish people on the holiest day of the year, would go into this holiest spot of the temple. What would he do there? He would offer up incense, if you see the picture, right? Offer up incense. He would wait. He would go in there quickly. He would wait till he would have a pan with coals, put the incense on the coals. The room would then fill with smoke, like a cloud. That cloud represented the holiness of the divine presence that was present on Yom Kippur, and then he would leave. Now, the people standing outside used to get a little bit nervous, because it did happen throughout the temples, especially the second temple, that the Kohen Gadol wasn't up to par. He wasn't actually on the right level. And if he wasn't on the right level, because there was a whole corruption story in the second temple when the Jews were under Roman rule, and unfortunately something filtered through, and sometimes, and because of the Roman influence, there were high priests that bought their way into office. They weren't meant to be there in the first place. And unfortunately, they became the Kohen Gadol, but they weren't really fit to be the Kohen Gadol. And what used to happen sometimes is they would go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and something would happen to them. So it was always a nervous moment when he used to go in, and they would all wait for him to come outside, and therefore he wouldn't take a long time. Why do I say that? Because in this very, very beautiful moment, and I'm not going to go through the whole idea why incense and why that was so important, maybe a different time, maybe we have time at the end, but he would offer up incense, and on his way out, in this unique and very, very special moment, he would offer up a prayer, a short prayer. He wanted to be brief, because he didn't want the people outside all the way in the courtyard to be worrying. So he would offer up a prayer. And the prayer had some very important things. He would say to God, please, would you please bless the world this year, and bless the Jewish nation. It should be a year where there's rain. It should be a year where there's health. And a few important key blessings. And then randomly at the end, he would include the following prayer. Listen carefully. He would say, may it be a year where no woman will miscarry. Shelo tapil isha pri bitna. Now, it's a really strange inclusion. He's saying a very key, you know, he's giving, I mean, he could just do it generally, right? Why does he just say that should be a year that people have children and healthy children, and right? And there shouldn't be infertile people, whatever. A very carefully worded prayer, which doesn't seem to fit into the general nature of the other sort of sentences, he would pick out a specific prat, a specific detail, and say, may it be a year where no woman should miscarry. What does that mean? That's a very strange thing, no? So some of the commentaries explain the following way. It was actually a very, very powerful prayer. Because actually it wasn't talking about the physical woman and the physical child. What it was referring to was spiritual pregnancy and spiritual birth. What does that mean? What he was saying is like this. When we come to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, there's an amazing energy. There's an amazing blessing. There are amazing things, Kabbalistically, spiritually, that happen on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Hopefully we ourselves go through a bit of an inspiration and uplift, right? As the commentaries tell us, the reason that we tell the story of the Kohen Gadol is because on Yom Kippur we become our own Kohen Gadol, spiritually. And we go deep, deep, deep into our own Holy of Holies. We go into our soul, and we go into places of our soul perhaps that we can't go the whole year round, but we're able to go on Yom Kippur, right? And we fill ourselves up with this amazing holiness and amazing potential. But it's potential. At that point, it's potential. It hasn't been born yet. It hasn't been applied. It's what we call spiritual pregnancy. Right? Comes along the Kohen Gadol, and as he's in this amazing moment, he turns to God and he asks for the regular blessings, of course, the physical and material blessings. And then he adds one. The Isha, the woman that he's talking about, are the Jewish people. We know that the Jewish people are compared to the woman and God is compared to the man. It's a marriage, right? So it's the Isha that he's referring to is the Jewish people, and he says, may this be a year that no woman shall miscarry, which means every woman should carry her baby to term and give birth. May this be a year where the people standing out there in the courtyard who have filled themselves up with such energy, with such spiritual potential, with such spiritual purity, as they leave Yom Kippur, they should carry it to term and give birth to it throughout the year. They should apply it. They should implement it. There should be a birth, a spiritual birth, not just a spiritual pregnancy. It's interesting, this is actually connected to something we say on Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah, I don't know if you're familiar with the Machzor, but you know how we, in the repetition of the Musaf, we blow the shofar three times. And every time they blow the shofar, we say this paragraph that begins, Hayom Harat Olam. And sung in different tunes, different synagogues, right? What does it mean, Hayom Harat Olam? It's got a few translations. One translation, Hayom Harat Olam, means today the world trembles. But often, if you look at a Machzor, in the English Machzor, you'll see it translated as, Hayom Harat Olam, today is the birthday of the world. Right? Which we say Rosh Hashanah is. But it chooses a very strange expression for birthday. Because actually, if you look at the word harat, hayom harat olam, and you look at its origin in Tanakh, where it comes from, there it actually means pregnancy. Hirayon in Hebrew is pregnancy, not birth. It can mean birth, but it really means pregnancy. And yet we say hayom harat olam, and what we mean is today is the birth of the world, and it's the same idea. Because what we're really praying for, we're saying, Hayom Harat Olam, today is the pregnancy of the world. In other words, everything happens today in potential. But we also want it to be the birthday of the world. We're looking forward to the birth. That whatever happens in Rosh Hashanah should be applied, should be revealed, should carry through to the rest of the year. Whatever commitments we make, whatever enthusiasm we achieve, whatever spiritual energy we are able to connect to, should be carried through to the rest of the year, and give birth to it so that we can actually change us and make us different in the coming year. So that's the prayer of the Yom Kippur. Now, sometimes, however, even though we have moments of inspiration, we have moments of holiness, we have moments of enthusiasm, sometimes what happens is we aren't able to take it to term. We aren't able to give birth to it. Why? Because we're stuck. I heard a very beautiful story. I resonated with it because it's about flying, you know, flying an airplane. So I tell a story of a guy that was taking a trip. A month before the trip, he made sure to book his seat because he needs to have an aisle seat. I'm like that also. I must have an aisle seat. It's enough being kvetched on the aisle seat for 24 hours. To be in the middle is terrible. Right? So this guy books an aisle seat and he books the 38C. C is always the aisle, right? Anyway. He's on the way home and he gets onto the plane or he prints his boarding pass, whatever, and lo and behold, they gave him the wrong seat. It's 38B. And he's incredibly angry and he gets up on the plane and he's grumpy and he gets on the 38B and he sits there and he's upset and his whole trip is devastated and ruined and the whole thing. Comes home and he lets it out to his wife and he says, you don't have no idea, how was your trip? It's terrible. Why is it terrible? Months before I booked the seat, 38C, and I get into 38B. What a chutzpah, how can they do that to me? I'm going to let them out, but I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. His wife lets him rant for 10 minutes and she says to him, I don't understand. If it's so important to you, why don't you just ask the guy in 38C to switch with you maybe? You should have tried it out. He says, I wanted to, but there was no one sitting there to talk to. So it's funny, but we all like that a little bit, right? The opportunity for growth, the opportunity to move, the opportunity to switch seats is right there. And we don't do it because we're focused on what the problem is. We're focused on the 38B. We're not moving. We're just upset about 38B, but there's a 38C waiting for you there. But I'm upset because I'm in 38B and I'm stuck there. So being stuck is a big problem, right? Right? which when I heard the story, I heard it together with a different story, also a beautiful story, and it's a story we need to really ask ourselves this question. It's a story about the camel question. Maybe some of you heard the story. Right? There was two camels in a zoo, a mother and a child. And the child camel turns to the mother and says, I got a couple of questions. I'm looking around the whole zoo, Manishtana, why are we different to all the other animals? Why are our legs shaped differently? So the mother says, what are you talking about? It's an unbelievable gift from God, the way he designed us. Because camels go in very hot deserts and they travel for miles on end. That's why, you know, the feet are shaped in a certain way. He says, okay, but why are our eyelashes longer than everyone else? He says, yeah, because we go in the very hot sun and we need to be protected. Okay, I have one more question. He says, so why do we have these ugly humps? So the mother says, don't you understand? Same reason, because we go for such long trips and we go into, through deserts where there's no water. Right? And when there's no water, we have to store water. And the camels have this unbelievable gift that no other animal has. They're able to store water so they could be hydrated throughout the very, very long trips. So the baby camel says, and he's thinking, he says, it's really, really good. So I have one final question. So then what are we doing in the cage in the zoo? Right? If it's all about traveling these long distances in the desert, what are we doing in the cage? And that's the question. The question we have to ask ourselves on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is, are we in the cage? Are we stuck in 38B? Right? That's the question we have to ask ourselves. Because really, we don't have to be stuck. You know, there's an amazing idea. We say human beings are created b'tzelem Elohim, in the image of God. The word tzelem means like in the form of God, right? Image of God, form of God. So there's an unbelievable question. The question is, what does it mean they're created in the form of God? One of the fundamentals of Jewish faith is that God doesn't have a form. Doesn't have an image. We say this in the Yigdal song that we sing on Friday night, right? And Lord Demuta Guf, Eino Guf, we say in the song, he has no body, he has no limitation, he has no image, he has no specific form. God is has no form. So what does it mean we're created in the form of God? So there's many, many different answers for that. But one of the answers is, that's exactly the point. We are created in the form of God, that we have no form. We are flexible. We're what's the word? We're expandable. We don't have to be stuck in any particular context. We can move. We can grow. So let's go back to Kol Nidre now. So Kol Nidre works like this. So why do we get stuck in a cage? Why does that happen? If we have such infinite potential, especially the potential that we absorb, hopefully, on these amazing days, why? Why don't we sometimes take, why are we, why don't we grow? Why don't we take the next step? We all have our things in our life that we get stuck in, but why? Why are we stuck? So there are many, many reasons. We're sometimes fear, insecurity, social pressure, whatever the reason is. But the main reason is Kol Nidre. Let's understand this. The main reason is like this. Kol Nidre, we talk about vows, promises. Right? A promise is a binding thing. Now, there are two kinds of promises. Now, again, when I give you this explanation, I'm not trying to undermine the legalistic interpretation of Kol Nidre, because that is true. And we are taught in the Talmud, the one should annul all the vows before Yom Kippur comes along. But everything happens on many levels, as we know, and there's a deeper layer to all of this, right? So, there's different types of promises. Sometimes a promise you make to someone else. So the promise you make to someone else, I'm going to pick you up tomorrow morning, I promise you I'm going to give you $100, I'm going to bring you some chicken soup. Or you make promises, we're going to do things, right? We're going to, go to a shir, I'm going to come with you tomorrow to the city, whatever the case. Okay, those are promises, and those are important things. Remember, we have to keep them, and speech is an important thing. You know, there's even a halachic expression that many people use when they commit to doing something. There's an expression that many, many people use. They say, bli neder. Have you ever heard that? Bli neder. I'll meet you tomorrow at 12 o'clock, bli neder. And some people are very particular to say this because speech is a very binding thing, and therefore we don't want it to have the force of a vow, and therefore we say bli neder without any commitment, without any promise. Okay. But there's a different kind of promise. It's the promise that we lock ourselves into ourselves. Right? And that's the greatest impediment to growth. We define ourselves. We lock ourselves. We like make ourselves bound to a particular definition. That's a different type of vow. It's a negative vow. Where we talk ourselves into it, we almost promise ourselves that this is the way it is. Right? We almost commit and promise to be stuck. That's what human beings do. Right? I don't like that person. I want to have nothing to do with that person. Finished. Why don't you go say hello to the person? I'm telling you, I'm committed. I have nothing to do with that person. I don't like that person. They were not nice to me 6 months ago. I'm not doing it. Right? Almost like a vow. I'm not doing it. Promise. Right? Why don't you maybe engage in some more learning? Learning is not my thing. How do you know? You ever tried it? It's not my thing. It's not my thing. I'm telling you, it's not me. A decision, decided, commitment. A negative commitment, right? I'm not doing it, I'm not even trying it. Okay, it wasn't your thing a year ago, maybe now it is your thing, trying to try it, you know? And even things you don't like, you know, people even who aren't from Australia learn to eat Vegemite if they eat it enough times, you know what I'm saying? Like, no? Try it, you'll see it's actually good after a while. I know my sister-in-law, when my brother got married, eventually my sister-in-law started to like Marmite or Vegemite. She was American, she thought it was absolutely crazy. No, it's not that important, but in spiritual Marmite it is important, right? People say, you know, I had a bad experience in a relationship. I'm not committing to another relationship. I had a terrible, traumatic experience. I'm not doing it. That's it forever. I'm only 32. I'm not doing it. Finished. Right? Things like that. Or, you know, that person, you know what they did? I can never find it in my heart to forgive that person. Maybe that's true. Maybe that's true for today, but maybe next week is different, right? Maybe you'll relook at it. All these kind of things. Or, you know, I'm not the spiritual type. I'm not the religious type. And I don't, whatever. Like, all those kind of stuff, right? We lock ourselves. We all do this in different ways. We lock ourselves into definitions. So therefore, when it comes Yom Kippur, and Yom Kippur is an experience like no other, right? That's the truth. Yom Kippur is the holiest day of the year, and Yom Kippur is a day that we're going to connect. I've shared this with you before, but we're going to connect to the deepest part of our soul, right? So we've shared this idea before. The soul has five layers, right? Four layers are the way we function. The layer of the functionality, behavior, the layer of emotion, the layer of cognition, the layer of subconscious, and then there's the yechidah, the essence, the core essence of our neshama, which we've talked about a lot of times. Yom Kippur is not just an experience where we connect to the soul at the deepest level, the whole day is like that. That's why, I don't know if I've shared this with you before, but that's why in Yom Kippur, in the Machzor, there are five prayers, different to every other day of the year. So a normal Jewish day involves three prayers, the morning prayer, the afternoon prayer, and the evening prayer, right? Shacharit, Mincha, and Arvit. Shabbat and festivals have four prayers that we call a Musaf, an additional prayer. It's only one day of the year we have five prayers. Because we have the extra one called Ne'ilah at the end. Right? Why is that? The way it works is because on a regular day, when we go about our regular stuff, we connect to the part of our soul that is conscious. The conscious part of our soul. Behavior, interactions, emotions, thinking. Shabbat and festivals, we're able to go a little bit deeper, so we go to the subconscious. But there's a day like no other, which is Yom Kippur, where we're able to go into the Yechidah, we're all going to the fifth layer, that ultimate layer of the soul, the deepest layer of the soul. What lives in that deepest layer of the soul? Infinite potential. Lots of things live there, but what lives in that deepest layer of the soul? Infinite potential. That's the part of our soul that was never ever damaged. That's the part of our soul that was never corrupted. That's a part of our soul that is always pure. It's an infusion of godliness. It has infinity to it. That's the part of our soul that gives us the ability not to be created in an image, but to be imageless, so to speak. To go beyond who we are. To undo the shackles that imprison us and hold us back from growing. That's where that soul is. Incidentally, that's why, and I'm just going to digress here for a minute, that's why the Kohen Gadol, right? That's why the Kohen Gadol, when he went into the Holy of Holies, brought incense. Why incense? So we know, just like there's five layers of the soul, there are also five senses. Yeah? Five senses. Sight, hearing, taste, touch, and smell. Right? I'll tell you a fascinating thing. If you look all the way back at in the book of Genesis, Bereshit, in the very, very first transgression of the human being, when Adam and Eve transgressed with the first fruit, right? The forbidden fruit. If you see there, there's four out of the five senses that are mentioned. Sight, when the snake spoke to Eve, she saw the fruit and she saw they were good. Touch, she took the fruit. She gave it to Adam, and they ate, taste. And then they heard the voice of God looking for them. Four out of the five senses. Doesn't say anywhere that they smelled, right? So the Kabbalists explain an amazing thing, that the five senses correspond to the five layers of the soul, right? We know that out of the five layers of the souls, we've talked about this many times, only four of them can be damaged. The fifth is never damaged. So in the very right, the fifth remains pure, always. That's a part of us that always remains pure. That's a part of us that we connect to so we can rebuild afterwards if we've messed up. We can only mess up on the four layers. We can't mess up on that layer, on that core essence of who we are. It can be very hidden, but we can't mess up on it. So in the very, very first transgression, when they introduced impurity into the world, but the very first failing of Adam and Eve, lack of self-control, whatever the case was, when they ate from the fruit, four out of the five senses are mentioned. Because four of the layers of the soul are damaged through transgression, but not the fifth. Right? And we know this to be true also with, it's interesting, because if you take the five senses, right, the four out of the five senses are things that most people are tempted with. Right? And challenged with. We're all challenged with sight. Like, look at the things that we shouldn't look at. Look into people's business that we shouldn't look in. Or whatever the case is, right? Hearing is one of the greatest challenges. Listening to gossip, listening to Lashon Hara, right? Listening to things we shouldn't be looking at, listening to, and so on and so forth. Taste, indulgence, speaking badly, ineffective communication, negative communication, and so on and so forth. Touching, taking things we shouldn't touch, getting involved in things, touching things we shouldn't touch, getting involved in things we shouldn't get involved in, right? All those four senses. Most people, unless they're unwell, are not tempted with smell. I mean, there are sicknesses that have to do with smell, but, right? But like someone who can't control themselves and likes to indulge in good food all the time, they aren't necessarily driven to always go and smell the nice things, right? Because the Kabbalists tell us that the sense of smell is the most spiritual part of the person. Even though we talk about these five senses and they're five physical senses, smell is the one that relates to the depth of the soul. Out of the five senses, smell is the one sense that relates to the fifth layer of the soul. Right? So therefore, Yom Kippur, when the Kohen Gadol and the High Priest goes into the Holy of Holies, the holiest moment of Yom Kippur, where he's connecting to the deepest part of the whole experience, and he's representing the Jewish nation who are connecting to their deepest level of their soul, they're connecting to the fifth layer, what does he bring? He brings incense. Right? He brings incense. Creates an aroma, a beautiful smell. Because that's the level of smell of the neshama, which is not tainted. But here's the thing, same idea we said before. The Talmud says the most fascinating and bizarre thing, almost seems like a random detail. It says that when the Kohen Gadol used to bring the incense, it was so powerful. The aroma was so powerful that he created through the incense in the Holy of Holies, that miles away in the city of Jericho, the goats used to sneeze. Now, if there's ever a random detail in the Talmud like that, I mean, sure. What's that supposed to mean? What do I care about the goats in Jericho? Right? There's a very deep thing in that sentence. Because the connecting to the fifth level on Yom Kippur, that's potential, that's pregnancy. We have to give birth to that experience. Says the Talmud, the purpose of that aroma is not to remain in the Holy of Holies. It's not to remain in Yom Kippur. It's that even the goats are symbolic of the animal part of who we are, the physical part of who we are, need to be affected by that aroma miles away, meaning months away, if you translate it into a year journey, right? So the Kohen Gadol created this unbelievable aroma representing the deepest part of the soul, but the idea is it's supposed to affect even the goats in Jericho. It's supposed to affect even 3 months later, after Yom Kippur, we're in the middle of who knows what, the middle of a regular Tuesday afternoon, you're supposed to be influenced and impacted on by that experience. Yeah.
When I lived overseas, I met people who bought oranges to shul during Rosh Hashanah with clothes in.
Yom Kippur.
Yeah. Yom Kippur.
Yeah. So maybe that's it's symbolic of that idea. Yeah, there's also an idea. I know that there's also a thing where people smell things in Yom Kippur, also it gives them a bit of strength to fast. But maybe it's symbolic of that idea. Could be. Right? So here's the point. That's why Kol Nidre is such an important prayer. Why? When we start Yom Kippur, and we know we're about to embark on this incredible experience, we need to free ourselves. We need to stop promising ourselves who we are. We have to stop getting stuck. We have to stop locking ourselves into who we think we are. The only way to really experience Yom Kippur properly is at the very, very beginning to annul all vows. To let ourselves break free. To go into this Yom Kippur and to say, I know Yom Kippur, we're going to connect to the deepest part of our soul, but I don't want it to get stuck there. I want to give birth to it. I want it to be able to impact and affect every part of who I am. And therefore, I'm canceling all promises. I'm going into Yom Kippur and I'm saying I'm not going to define myself anymore in any way. I'm not going to say I'm stuck. I'm not going to say I'm an angry person. I'm a jealous person. I'm upset with this one. I'm upset with that one. I'm not spiritual. I'm not religious. I'm not this. I'm not that. I'm going to allow myself to expand. I'm going to allow myself to grow. I'm going to allow myself that the experience of Yom Kippur should have some impact on me, on the rest of the layers of myself. I'm going to allow myself to think about something that I could do in the coming year that might be a little difficult, manageable, as we always talk about. We can't take on everything at once. But something that maybe I didn't think spoke to me, or I didn't think resonates with me, or I thought maybe it's too difficult for me, and I'm going to embark on it. I'm going to entertain it. I'm going to engage it. Why? Because I'm not going to lock myself in. I'm going to make up with someone that maybe I don't like, even after Yom Kippur. And not say on Yom Kippur, but after Yom Kippur, you know, I've always told you the story. I'll tell it again because it's a good story. Right? You know the story about at the end of Yom Kippur when in a shtetl, when the rabbi was sitting and breaking his fast with his family, there was a knock at the door. And who's at the door? It was the shtetl ganef, the shtetl thief. Every shtetl had a thief. Every shtetl had a drunkard. Every shtetl had a thief. That's how it used to go, right? And he's got a big sack on his shoulder. And he comes into the rabbi's study and says, oh, kutyanta, kutyar, kushana tava, how are you? He says, Rabbi, this is Rabbi's dream, right? Rabbi, your ne'ilah drosha today in shul was unbelievable. I was just so inspired. I was so inspired to the point that I've actually come to give you back some of the stuff that I've stolen. And you can distribute it. Oh, the rabbi is so back with himself, right? You know, drosha actually had an impact, unbelievable. So he takes it back and they exchange pleasantries. They wish each other Shana Tova and the ganav goes on his way. And it's getting late and the rabbi wants to bench. He looks at his clock and his watch and it's gone. It's gone. So he says, quick, bring the ganav back. So they go and find him and they march him back to the rabbi. And the rabbi turns to the ganav. He says, I don't understand. You come in here, you tell me my needle drasha was unbelievable. You were inspired, you uplifted, you give me back some of the things you stole. And now you took my watch. What's the... He says, Rabbi, what don't you understand? Your ne'ilah drasha was fantastic. I was inspired. I did something about it. But now it's after Yom Kippur. Rabbi, now business is business. So that's what we have to go into Yom Kippur. That's why Kol Nidre is the foundation of Yom Kippur. Kol Nidre is when we get up and we say, before we start, the sun hasn't even gone down properly. We're just about to go and start the journey of Yom Kippur. We say, Kol Nidre, if there's any vows, any promises, any definitions, any commitments that I've made to myself in a negative way, that I've locked myself into a particular thing, any cage that I put in myself, any middle seat of the airplane that I put myself in and think I'm stuck there, I'm no stuck. I'm breaking free. So that when I experience the Yom Kippur service, the Kippur, the holiness, it'll be like the Kohen Gadol prayed when he came out of the Holy of Holies, that we shouldn't miscarry, we should bring it to term and give birth to the experience of Yom Kippur. And that's the power of Kol Nidre. That's why it's such an important prayer. So, I just want to remind everyone again, this coming Monday night is the Zoom on the Zoom on the Machzor, which we're going to do. Also, anyone's interested in the second day Minyan? Yep.
What was the code for the Zoom?
Do you get my WhatsApps?
Yeah.
Okay, it's on there. I will send it. I will send it out today. So I'll send it out today. Okay, I'll send you. You know what? It's on here. You can take the supply. No, I'll give it to you. Okay, as soon as I finish, I'll give you this thing. So just that, and as I said, we're not gonna. This is last year, so in case you haven't seen anyone before, Rosh Hashanah, we wish everyone a Shana Tova, a really good year, a happy year, a meaningful, a year of growth, and a year of good blessing for you and your families. And remember that I will do a thing in the middle of Sukkot, so please stay tuned. Some other kind of things coming up, so just stay tuned on all the WhatsApps and the emails and. We'll start the regular Shurim after Sukkot, after Simchat Torah at the other end. Have a wonderful day, everyone.